Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and the decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUS Cast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammernis, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We are here today to discuss SEC versus Jarchese, in which the Supreme Court issued a 6-3 decision on June 27, 2024. It is my honor to introduce our guest today, Devin Watkins. Devin is an attorney at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Devin previously worked at the Cato Institute as a legal associate and intern at the Institute for Justice. And with that, I'd like to turn things over to Devin to get us started.
I'm happy to be here. So I'm here to talk about Jarchese, which, at least in my opinion, is one of the most important Supreme Court decisions in a very long time. There are probably two critically important Supreme Court decisions this term on the size, scope, and power of the administrative state. Of course, the overturning of Chevron has enormous implications for the rulemaking process that all federal agencies go through. But in many ways, Jarchese is important for the adjudication process is as the overturning of Chevron was for the rulemaking process. This is the other half of agencies' formal powers. So in this case, let me go into a little bit of the kind of factual background. At least according to the ALJs, as found by the SEC, Jarchese had claimed to brokers and investors that some prominent accounting firm would audit the hedge fund, that some prominent investment bank would serve as the fund's primary broker, and that half the funds would be invested in life insurance policies. The ALJ found that no audit had taken place, no prime brokerage account was open, and only 20% was invested. And so he and the ALJ and the SEC found that Jarchese had committed securities fraud. Now, I don't know if these facts are true or false, and there was no jury involved in this, despite the fact that Jarchese had asked for one. The Fifth Circuit reviewed the findings of the SEC and ALJ, and they found that there were three problems with the process that the SEC went through. Specifically, that the SEC had the discretion to bring the case either within federal court or through its administrative process, but that there was no kind of intelligible principle telling the SEC which one it should go for. And so it violated the non-delegation doctrine for the SEC to make that choice without being told by Congress how it should be making that choice. The second problem was that there was a for-cause restriction on the administrative law judge's removal that violated Article 2 in the separation of powers. And lastly, that Jarchese was entitled to a jury trial under the Seventh Amendment. Now, the Supreme Court only decided that third question, specifically on the Seventh Amendment, and left the other two to go back to the Fifth Circuit and the future cases. So those two are still live issues in future cases. But because the Supreme Court was able to resolve it entirely on the Seventh Amendment grounds, that is the entire basis for the Supreme Court's opinion. So I'm going to be focusing on that aspect of it here. So the Seventh Amendment says, in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. So the key question then in this case is, what is a suit at common law? According to the SEC, any administrative action brought in its administrative forum is not a suit at common law, because a suit at common law meant in federal court. If you don't go to court, it's not a suit, and therefore it doesn't matter under the Seventh Amendment. We don't need a jury as long as we don't bring it outside of an Article III court. Now, there's some problems with this. If that were actually the case, then Congress could effectively eliminate the Seventh Amendment right and just assign everything to administrative forums or outside courts and just eliminate the right to a trial by jury in all actions. And that seems rather absurd given the history of the Seventh Amendment. The Seventh Amendment was created in response to certain abuses by the English government that occurred shortly before the American Revolution. There was a lot of restrictions on trading, specifically that certain goods and ships had to go through, everything had to go through England, had to be bought and sold certain goods through England before it could come to or be sold by the American colonies. This caused prices to go up a lot more than if they had sold directly to foreign governments or foreign individuals. And there was a lot of Americans that were upset by that. And because of that, there was a lot of Americans that committed smuggling and kind of avoided those restrictions. The British government then brought smuggling charges against American colonists. And the American colonists who sat on juries were rather hesitant to convict their fellow American colonists of these crimes. They were very skeptical and kind of really pushed back against a lot of the extravagance in a lot of the prosecutions. And there was a lot of complaints by the British governors that were selected by the English authorities about this. So what the English Parliament decided to do is transfer all of these from English common law courts to admiralty courts that had no jury trials and therefore bypassed the right to a jury and just have individuals that were selected by the British government deciding if these people were guilty and issuing fines. That was the history that then led to the Seventh Amendment that protected these kind of actions and ensured that a jury trial would be allowed. Now, it does say in Sousa common law, and at the founding, there was kind of three different areas of law where different cases could be brought. You could bring cases in the common law courts, the courts of equity, and the courts of admiralty. The admiralty courts are for things that occur on the high seas. There's a natural reason to not have a jury in these cases because the actions occurred at the high seas. There is no local jury in the middle of the ocean that you can then call for to decide issues of fact. Issues of equity was another exception that is distinguished from common law courts. In these cases, you're not trying to punish anyone. You're not taking property from them that they own because they committed some wrongdoing. Instead, you're saying what needs to happen in the future to follow the law. And you're trying to set things right. And because you're not actually punishing anyone, and there's no decision as to some bad act that occurred in the past, the ability for the government to kind of abuse that process, even without a jury, is a lot less because any decisions made would not generally apply just to the individuals involved, but would then be applicable to anyone in society under equal facts. And so in those cases, admiralty and equity, the founders did not believe that a jury was required, but they did want to preserve it at suits of common law. Now, suits at common law only meant cases brought in court. It could be easily evaded. Instead, at least my opinion is that suits of common law meant suits that at that time would have been brought in common law. Meaning that there are suits for damages or to remedy past harms by taking property that people had and giving it to those that were harmed or to the government. Any of these kind of cases were suits at common law. And in those kinds of cases, we need to have a jury trial. And that's mostly what the majority held in this case. One of the key problems is that there are some cases, what's called public rights cases, that where there was no jury involved in the process. Now, a lot of these are cases where even I would not characterize them as suits at common law, although they might involve money. An example might be a federal benefit program. If the government is handing out money and it's not taking money from people that is properly theirs, That the adjudication of that is not a suit at common law. There's no punishment involved in making such a decision. And so though it involves money, it can be done outside of the jury process. There's a variety of other areas that the court identifies, such as certain immigration law, some tax law. For instance, some tax collector is taking money in for the government, and although they take the money in for the government, they then fail to pass it along to the treasury. The government can go and say, look, you use that money to buy the house. We're now going to sell that house and collect the money that is properly ours, the government. We're not just punishing you because of this. We're just trying to take the money that the government already owns. This is our money. And so in those kind of what's called public rights cases, no jury needed to be involved. And those all started perfectly acceptable. You know, some of these public benefits, some tax cases, stuff like that. There were several of these kind of cases. The problem is that in the 1977 case of Atlas Roofing, the Supreme Court expanded that public rights doctrine to include not just those kind of traditional areas where most people would say that's not a lawsuit at common law, but tried to then claim that anytime the government is exercising sovereign power related to a federal statute that gives the government that power, that it automatically then becomes a public right. And therefore the government can bypass the jury trial right. I actually filed a brief in Jarchese and asked the Supreme Court to overrule Atlas Roofing. The majority declined to do so. Instead, what they decided to do is distinguish Atlas Roofing and say that the OSHA Act did not involve the kind of traditional common law actions like involved in this case. In this case, which involved fraud and securities fraud, the court found it was very similar to common law fraud that would have been brought in a common law court at the founding, and therefore was clearly a suit at common law at the time of the founding. They then distinguished the OSHA Act and said that's an entirely separate scheme. It was unrelated to a lot of things that occurred at the founding, and therefore we don't need to deal with Atlas Roofing and its constitutionality right now. Instead, it relied upon two cases, Toll v. United States and Grand Pharmacia v. Norberg. This was a 1987 and 1989 case. Toll dealt with the Clean Water Act and a fine that was issued. The court there said a fine under the Clean Water Act was very similar to an action in debt at common law, and therefore would fall within the Seventh Amendment. And in Grand Pharmacia, the court said that a fraudulent conveyance actions are legal in nature and require a jury trial. So it was those cases that the majority primarily relied upon to say that a securities fraud case is similar enough to a suit at common law that it needs to have a jury trial to be able to be functional. And this and often will push the case out of administrative forum. Because administrative forums don't have jury trials, the ability to bring these cases in administrative forum is going to be limited. Instead, a lot of these cases are going to then be brought in Article III courts where they can have jury trials. And these cases really should be in Article III courts where you have a real jury that is going, a real judge that can evaluate these under Article III as well as a jury. I think both of those are true, although this case focused specifically on the right to a jury trial. Now, the dissent primarily focuses on the fact that although the court distinguished Atlas Roofing, according to the dissent, it shouldn't have, that Atlas Roofing really controlled this case. That this case, while the majority said that the remedy at issue, issuing a monetary fine, is what causes this to require a jury trial under the Seventh Amendment, the dissent said, look, Atlas Roofing had a fine just like this one. And it said that the dissent claims that the securities fraud statute is the creation of a new statute, not the same as the common law fraud, because it doesn't require any kind of injury to private parties. It is brought by the government in its sovereign capacity and directly by the government. It's not a litigation between two private parties. Now, I have some, I can see the dissent's point in some ways. I agree that this is not that much different between Atlas Roofing. This is why we asked that Atlas Roofing be overruled. We think that Atlas Roofing was wrong to decide that. The Supreme Court was kind of careful not to say whether Atlas Roofing was rightly decided. In fact, they suggested that Atlas Roofing may already have been overturned, but they don't actually decide that here, which is kind of strange. Usually the court is clear what cases are good law and what cases are it's not good law when it's citing those cases. But the dissent also takes issue with the fact the majority is kind of making that kind of distinction where it says we're going to distinguish Atlas Roofing, but we're not going to say if Atlas Roofing is good law. So I can understand why the dissent is making those claims. I would just say that even if the dissent is right, I think the court should have overruled Atlas Roofing.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental power is essential to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's FEDSOC.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.